Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And continually, it is brought to you by you. Thank you to our patrons supporting us every week at patreon.com/utech. You are gods to us. And if you are a patron, a god to us, then this is your extended cut of this week's show. And if you're not yet a patron but would like to get our extended longer cuts or our as live versions, which this week is about 21 minutes longer than our extended cut, thanks to our deep discussion about everything from British Edge network technology to Ian's cats, then you can go to patreon.com/UK tech, and we do weekly columns and things there as well. So thank you very much to everyone who's supporting us there. And Rob Hughes, who I believe joined us shortly after we recorded last week's show. So thank you very much, Rob, for joining us, and to everyone else who's there already. Well, this week, the government announced that a specialist squad of prison and police officers has been formed to tackle the threat drones allegedly posed to prison security. In a statement, the government said the team of investigators will work closely with national law enforcement agencies and the prison service to inspect drones that have been recovered from prisons in a bid to identify and track down the people involved in attempting to smuggle in contraband. Now, crucially, it says, this new setup will investigate the specific drones used by individuals around prisons. And they're doing this as frequently drones are being used to smuggle in things like drugs and mobile phones in particular into prisons. There have been convictions, apparently. I've seen a few. I mean, some of these sentences they actually get are several years long, at least in recent history. But it's a growing problem, I think, probably in part to the fact that the cost of the drones are very low now, and they're shrinking in size and in noise. So now, I particularly liked Engadget's fairly down-to-earth summary, which was, quote, if you're picturing a crack team of drone gun-wielding heavies with eagles perched on their shoulders, sorry to burst your bubble, but it's more of an intel-sharing initiative. This was something the BBC agreed with and described them more down-to-earth as involving forensic examination of captured drones to try and find out who was flying them. Now, Ian, I know that when I put this in the lineup, you were very excited about this.
Yes.
In fact, I think you marked it with the word yes in yes. bold in red. So why don't you tell me why you're so excited by this?
I mean, because I sort of appreciate that this is actually, it's obviously a really big problem, and it's a problem that we just wouldn't have without technology. Like, drones make it very easy to smuggle things into prison, ultimately. If you can communicate to someone inside when the drone will be overhead and where it will come overhead, then they can be waiting, and it's almost certainly possible to evade detection in so doing. There was a good story actually in the US about some prisoners who'd managed to they'd been involved in part of the stripping down of old computers, which they it was part of a government program that they would earn money for, I guess. And they had built their own set of computers that they'd hidden in the ceiling. So prisoners are very cunning when it comes to breaking the rules and getting things that they want, and obviously drones was a natural way of. And I remember we had talked about this before, didn't we? And increasingly, I feel like drone companies are going to build into the software things like geofencing that stops drones from going anywhere near prisons, essentially, because there's no reason for them to.
Prisons, airports and government bases is exactly one method that's been mooted. And another method is simply to have kind of, not radar, sort of radar, but essentially drone blasting technologies where they block the frequencies used so they would fall out of the sky. But then I think that what would probably happen is, because a lot of the drones, certainly the higher end ones, have GPS, they know where they took off from. So if they came into a problem where they lost contact with the controller, they would simply turn around and go back to its last known point, or at least
and then
back.
They'd follow them and stuff and find out where the people were.
But it's interesting you mentioned the US, because this problem does exist outside of the UK, of course. And I looked at some details about where and how. And in 2015, according to a story I saw in the Washington Post, written last year, there was a bit of a scuffle at a prison in Ohio, where a drone dropped heroin into the exercise yard of one prison. And then a little more recently in Maryland, the same paper reported, prosecutors did convict a recently released inmate and a prisoner serving a life sentence on charges of attempting to distribute drugs in prisons by delivering contraband during several nighttime missions, which apparently netted them about $6,000 per drop in product sales. And it was so lucrative a scheme that the former inmate had purchased a new truck with the profits.
Wow.
So that was amazing. I mean, they were convicted as well. So it's not just in the UK. It's not just in the US. There were global examples too. But it's obviously a developing problem.
Well, what I was going to say is that the big problem really is going to be that it's actually very easy to build your own drone without buying a DJI or whatever. Because the components are relatively straightforward. There are things like Arduinos, however it's pronounced, that will, with pre-built specs that would get you a drone in the air. So the problem will not go away just because of what the big manufacturers do. It'll make it a little bit more inaccessible to novices. But I like anything in crime, there's always someone with a specialism who can, help you out. So it is going to be an ongoing issue. And so it's interesting to see that they're getting on top of it.
Well, back in 1990s, I think what we used to call them are radio-controlled planes. Didn't we?
Yeah, sorry. I mean, I thought that there was something about that sentence that made me feel like it was going to be longer than it actually was. Yeah,
no.
Exactly. And I mean, also, as simple as just people walking up to prison walls and throwing stuff over. I mean, there's always been a problem of this kind. It's just getting slightly different.
Yeah. Well, John Podmore, who was the former head of the Prison Services Anti-Corruption Unit, said that while there was an issue with contraband in prisons, targeting this money at drones was, quote, a PR stunt. This was with him talking to the BBC. And he said, quote, "I've seen no evidence that there is a real problem with drones. I think the number of incidents last year was 33. There are some 10,000 mobile phones found every year in prison. My question to the prison service would be, how many of those were found hanging from drones?" Now, I see his point, but 33 is more than there was. And if it's 33 now, it might be 330 next year. It might be 3,300 the year
after. And also, that's 33 incidents they know about, right?
Yes,
so
true.
For every 33 incidents they know about, there must be, another 100 bags of heroin making it into prisons. And we know that there is a massive drugs problem in prisons, both here and in the US. And it's considered to be, a real issue because, if nothing else, prison is supposed to be a way for, convicts to rehabilitate themselves. And if you're a drug addict, then you go into prison, you've got no choice but to give up. And that can be a huge boost. That can be a great kickstart to being clean when you get on the outside and, turning your life around, which is ultimately what prison is all about anyway. Right? It's not about punishment, is it? It's supposed to be rehabilitation.
Well, we could drone on about this for a long time, but you may fly in your opinions to podcast@nateslangston.com. Let us know what you think to crack teams tracking down drone flyers sending contraband to prison. podcast@nateslangston.com. Well, staying on the subject somewhat of law, Engadget pointed us towards the news this week that a government plan to introduce online convictions, allowing people who'd committed petty crimes to plead guilty online and pay fines without having to go to court, has been scrapped. Now, we discussed this in depth on episode 86 back in February, and it was intended, this system, to be used to pay fines for minor non-imprisonable offences that have a predetermined penalty. That's things like rail and tram fare, dodging, or fishing without the appropriate licence. Now, the online option was provided in what was called the Prison and Courts Bill, but it's been deprioritised as Parliament is now focusing on pushing through other legislation before the end of the current session, Engadget says, and ahead of the fantastic, much appreciated snap general election on the 8th of June. So instead, a public committee yesterday, that being, when would that have been? Probably the 20th, voted not to proceed anymore with this bill. So all that conversation, that highly informed, super detailed, and dare I say, fascinating conversation we had back in episode 86, Ian, is null and void, like this.
And I wasn't a fan, was I? But I do remember people pointed out that you can already pay certain fines online, can't you?
Yes.
Like parking tickets and stuff like that, and I think maybe speeding fines.
The difference here was the officially pleading guilty bit.
Yes, and I wasn't a big fan of that, and that was what caused me grief. I'm not particularly sorry to see it go. I think it needs to be quite well thought out if it's going to be pushed forward within the future. But hey, we're going to have our legal teams in government are going to be very, very busy for, you know, no matter what you feel about Brexit, moving all those EU laws into UK law is going to take some work, and we'll need, you know, there is going to be a lot of priorities around that, I think.
Yeah. Well, if you were planning to plead guilty to something on the internet and are now woefully...
Well, you still can. Just go on Twitter and plead guilty to it. It's just you won't be able to pay the fine.
Yes. let us know and tag us at TextMessagePod. Well, V3 this week covered news that BT and TalkTalk have been rated the worst internet service providers by their customers in a survey of 1,800 members by Which. Now, you'll note, hopefully, the scepticism and deep cynicism in my voice here. The UK's biggest broadband providers are still apparently disappointing on basic customer service and speed and reliability, says Which. Now, TalkTalk had an approval rating of a woeful 38% of its customers. BT 45% of its customers, Sky 48%, and EE 49%. Now, as V3 says, unfortunately, these four ISPs account for 72% of the UK broadband market. Now, in my opinion, surveys like these are always BS. They're nonsense. Angry masses motivated to choose to vote, while the happy either stay somewhat silent or just pipe up to support the little guy. And the little guys are often better, and certainly in this survey, they came out on top. I think Zen Internet had a very high rating for one. But nonetheless, it is worth pointing out that these surveys are often a crock, and hence why BT, Sky, TalkTalk, etc. all sit as the worst providers in the country. It makes me wonder why you lot are all still subscribing to them if they're that bad.
Well, I mean, I have said, and I do not believe that there is a place in this country for TalkTalk. I don't believe that company should exist. I think it should be shut and sold. And I think part of the ruling for that should be that absolutely, whoever set it up, like set up the infrastructure behind its customer, you know, whatever databases, needs to not be involved in whatever new company springs from it, because it's a disgrace.
Well, you may be wondering in that case, dearest listener, why did we mention this if we think that surveys like this are silly? Well, a little bit of it is I wanted to poke fun at it and also just to mention that it happened. But the real reason is because there's good news for the broader infrastructure market and for anyone who is disgruntled with their internet provider. Now, Ian, this is a story about Openreach and a proposal from Ofcom. Do you want to take us through this news?
Yeah, so basically Ofcom's got some proposals for improving access to Openreach's infrastructure, which will make it possible for competing broadband providers to put their own fibre products in BT's various cable runs and over, you know, using maybe even phone pylons, which is something we don't do for fibre in this country, but the Americans do have that system. So Openreach, obviously, I think we all know by now, surely, is the company that does all that back-end stuff for BT, fibre connections, ducts, pipes, etc. It's owned by BT, but there's been a ruling, hasn't there? They have to split it off. It has to be a separate company run by entirely separate people. And that will give access to rivals like Sky and EE to do what they want in the infrastructure. And Ofcom has said that Openreach has to provide that at a cost that's spread out amongst everyone. So it won't be possible to just charge, say, EE the full cost of going into those ducts and sort of running its own fibre.
Yeah, now Ofcom said in a statement that they've got some proposals and they'll make it quicker and easier for BT's competitors, as you say, to, you know, build their own fibre networks, perhaps all the way to people's doorsteps, using existing telegraph poles and the ducts and pipes and stuff, as you said. Now they've got, hang on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 proposals. Why don't you run us through these?
Yeah, so. Access on fair terms means that providers should be able to lay fibre using the ducts and poles as easily as BT can, And the cost for BT providing access should be spread across all its users, as I said. Excuse me. The network ready for use. Openreach must repair any faulty infrastructure and clear block tunnels necessary for providing access. Pretty standard.
Yeah, so essentially they would remain responsible for making it possible for companies to go in there. If a tunnel's
blocked. And they can't just leave it and say, well, it's your problem if you want to go in there. You know, obviously unacceptable. I mean, I have some sympathy for Openreach on this. I do sort of feel like they get quite put upon. But hey, it's a profitable business. They can probably survive. Mixed-use networks, so companies can lay fibre for consumers and large businesses, provided the purpose of the network is primarily to deliver broadband to homes and offices.
Homes and small offices. So I think the difference there is the companies can use the ducts to do like massive corporate like lease line type things, but it still has to be with the primary benefit of delivering to consumers. And I can
sort of see why they do that, because obviously if you get some small upstart company coming in and doing big lease lines or, you know, big fiber for businesses, it could cause problems, because obviously there's been an investment in that already. And so it makes sense to some extent. Final connections into homes means that BT should ensure its capacity is available on its telegraph poles for additional fiber cables that connect buildings to competitor networks. That could be interesting, I guess, if Virgin needs to fill in black spots on its network. It could essentially use BT's work to make that a bit more financially viable. That could be good in itself, because it would mean that Virgin would have access to more customers, and that would probably force BT into doing better fiber products for those same customers, essentially, because at the moment BT's not really competing, is it, for most customers. And the last thing is better information, which Openreach is sort of already does. It's got to create a digital map of its duct and pole network, so its competitors can plan networks. They already have a map, I think, but I think from what I gathered from reading the Ofcom page, they need to be, you know, stay on top of that and make sure that the map is good information.
That's very interesting. I mean, that's doubtful that it's something we'd ever get to see necessarily.
No, but I mean, I'd be fascinated to see it. I'm sure we could talk to a small ISP and get them to show us, because it would be quite interesting to see, wouldn't it? Like, there must be some places where there's either massive unused capacity or surprisingly little capacity.
Maybe that's something we could look into doing. Maybe we could go and speak to a company like Zen or Hyperoptic or somebody and talk to them about all these proposals and how it might benefit them. You know, it's easy enough to sort of know what the likes of TalkTalk and Sky and people think to all this, because their PR machines always make sure their opinions are broadcast widely, but the smaller guys often not. So maybe that's something we could do. And if you'd be interested in us doing that, do let us know, podcast@nateslangston.com, or if you work for one of these companies, obviously do get in touch. So those are the 5 points and proposals that Ofcom has made. Now, it's in consultation. The consultation will end in June, and whatever is decided upon in terms of proposing all this stuff into Openreach will come into effect next year, probably in the spring, so about a year away from now. Now, I was looking up some counterpoints to this, because most stories sort of parroted just Ofcom's lines here, but I did find an interesting comment, and this came from Matthew Howitt, who is an independent telecoms industry analyst, and he'd said, quote, access to Openreach's network has really been available for the past 6 years, but the uptake has been virtually nil, as companies could not make a business case out of putting their own fiber in BT's ducts. Making it cheaper by spreading the cost and easier by making the map clearer might help. If there really was a business case, I'm sure BT would have turned into a revenue stream to meet the demand, but it wasn't there. Rivals weren't queuing up asking for access. So what Howitt's basically saying here is, it's all well and good making this a thing that's more readily available, but they could do it anyway. Yeah. I suspect that the truth lies somewhere in between the two, and that maybe part of the reason why they didn't is because they never feel they're actually going to get a good deal from Openreach, because it's always going to benefit its parent BT. Maybe being entirely level, or at least as level as it can be, makes it more attractive to go in and do some of this stuff.
And I think it may have useful implications for those community projects, excuse me, that pop up from time to time, where someone decides that their village deserves better broadband, and so they fund it themselves. They put down infrastructure. I don't think, for the most part, I don't think it would be something that would get taken up by huge ISPs, because largely they can make money off the, you know, using the BT infrastructure, right? So. We'll see.
Anyway, let us know any thoughts you have on Ofcom's propositions and Openreach and broadband in general, and or, of course, the Which survey, if you want to disagree with me on that. podcast@nateslangson.com or @textmessagepod on Twitter. Quick one here. A payment card featuring a fingerprint sensor has been unveiled by MasterCard, and it follows a successful trial in South Africa. Essentially, this is, instead of putting your card into the little electronic reader and then tapping your PIN, you shove it into the reader and hold your finger on a little fingerprint sensor. Basically, the same as if you were paying with Android Pay or Apple Pay. And MasterCard said in a statement that South Africa is the first market to test this technology, and that two separate trials were recently conducted. One was in a leading supermarket retailer called Pick and Pay, and then Absa Bank, which is a subsidiary of Barclays over there in Africa. Cardholders have to enroll their card by registering with their bank, their financial institution, and then on registration, their fingerprint is converted, as it would be for anything else, into a little digital template that's stored on the card locally, and then you can use it at any card globally, it says at least. Over the next few months, there will be more trials. They're going to conduct one in Europe, apparently. They're going to conduct them in Asia Pacific as well. And MasterCard has said they expect a full rollout later this year. Now, the main reason that I wanted to mention this, and it was Ian's idea to include it, is because it makes for a good segue into the quite voluminous amount of feedback we had from last week's show about contactless cards and payments using things like Apple Pay and Android Pay. So just before we transition into some of those great pieces of feedback, Ian, your thoughts on the MasterCard thing? Because I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a really good solution to the problem of, you know, PINs being quite bad security generally, quite hard to remember. You know, fingerprint is, it's not hard to fake a fingerprint, but you can't necessarily do it in front of a store checkout because people will see what you're doing. So I think it gives you a sort of a decent amount of security, and it's a clever idea to build it into something without needing a whole load more equipment, because obviously retailers have all just spent a load of money probably upgrading to contactless machines. They probably won't want to do it again for something for fingerprints, so this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Well, let us know, of course, what you think about that. podcast@natelangson.com. Well, this is an apt time to move into our conversation about contactless spending feedback. We had a great, really great number of responses, and we've picked some of our favourites here. I had one interesting one come in from Mike Wigmore, actually, who on Twitter, who said, try to use phone and watch for contactless, he says, but tend to forget the facilities available. Not all shops provide contactless, so it's easier to default to my card.
Right.
Now, we also had, for the rare occasion, a bit of multimedia come into the show. This was from Richard Aldroyd. Now, I liked this. He sent us a message, and he said that he was inspired to record a really little sort of public service announcement on his YouTube channel about, to try and educate people about the fact that they can use their iPhones and their Android phones for contactless payments. And I loved this because I thought this is probably the most succinct, short, to the point explanation of reality as I've ever heard. So this is what Richard put out.
Did you know that Android Pay and Apple Pay work in exactly the same way as your contactless debit or credit card issued by your bank? If a shop accepts contactless payments, they accept your cards and your phones.
He's right, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's worth remembering. I mean, it is exactly the same system. And while I felt this was important, particularly when the thing first launched, because I had a conversation when I the first day Apple Pay came to the UK. I went to try it out in as many places as I could find to write a story about it. And I went to a chemist, which supported contactless, and I said, "Can I use my phone?" And she said, "No, only contactless cards." I was like, "Well, that's the same thing." But I didn't use it. So anyway, trivia.
Indeed, good trivia there. Well, thank you very much, Richard. In fact, both Richards. We had two Richards write in. No, we didn't. We had one Mike and one Richard, but here comes another Richard. This is from Richard, and he said, sent to podcast@natelangson.com, I usually use my Apple, my iPhone with Apple Pay at checkouts. However, I, for one, avoid paying for items at the till with my Apple Watch because it looks and feels so pretentious. It's interesting, that, isn't it? That's a real kind of stigma, isn't it? Being the one who uses the watch. Look at the nerd over there. But yeah. I agree. I think it's strange, and I think it's particularly it's heightened by embarrassment when it doesn't work, which I've seen several times.
It's, although, I do find that the Apple Watch is slightly more reliable. I guess because it's it doesn't have that distance thing that I have trouble with on the phone.
Mm. Well, Richard continues, if I'm at a self-checkout, I'll happily wave my wrist near the terminal. This hands-free method of payment is particularly useful when trying to hold a fractious toddler.
Amen to that.
Yeah, so it's
as
essentially
the owner of one fractious toddler, I can confirm.
Yeah, so Richard's basically saying he doesn't like doing it when he's in front of people, but when he's doing a self-checkout thing, the embarrassment is his and his alone, and that makes it a lot easier when you're with kids. So thank you, Richard, and Mike, for those bits of feedback. Now, this next one comes from Josh. This is a little more in-depth opportunity to discuss the issue. Josh says, hi, Nathan, Ian. Hi, Josh. Ian, say hello to Josh.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hello, Josh.
Josh continues. Love the show. Long time, first time. But by the way, that confused me initially, but I see what he means now. Long time listener, first time writer. Well, I'm glad you're here. Despite enjoying using my Apple Watch to pay at every opportunity, it still, on occasion, feels a bit awkward and slightly less seamless to use over cards. Firstly, when using contactless cards at a manned till point, the action of reaching for your wallet and cards will more often than not tell the cashier that you are using card to pay. I 100% agree, Josh. 100% agree with that. That is totally true. Josh continues, the cashier then presses the button and the card machine is ready by the time the card is in your hand. With my Apple Watch, it's already out, and I have to let the cashier know that I have a contactless device on my wrist that I'd like to pay with. Most cashiers eventually realize what I mean and don't stare at me blankly as I try to explain I can pay for my shopping with the same device I used to tell the time. However, what still exists, that awkward delay that is ultimately avoidable with a card. I agree. That is true. There's a little sort of it's almost like a body language cue, like people don't push past you on a train if it looks like you're about to get off. I deliberately don't look like I'm getting off just to annoy people, because that's the kind of guy I am. That's all me, by the way, not Josh. But Josh continues, secondly, I'm an in-house recruiter for the John Lewis and Waitrose brands, and as a result, I have not only my Waitrose and my John Lewis loyalty cards, but also own a partner discount card. My John Lewis has Apple Wallet functionality, however, neither my Waitrose nor the discount card does. As a result, when paying, it still feels silly to get my wallet out for other cards to then return my wallet to my pocket and use my watch for payment. I wonder if other people with various loyalty cards or discount cards, etc., come across this same awkwardness. Many thanks. Yeah, and that's from Josh. Great insights,
I enjoyed
Josh.
That. I'm a big shopper at Waitrose, so you know, I like Josh automatically.
Snob.
Not at all. If you've been in a Waitrose, you'll understand that it is a much nicer shopping experience than anywhere else.
I would happily pay more money to shop at a Waitrose every week.
If there was one near you.
Yes, there isn't.
But he's right, actually, and I don't know why there aren't loyalty cards and discount cards and stuff like that on Apple Pay. It shouldn't be that difficult, presumably. I guess it's because there's no financial transaction. It's not necessarily in Apple's interest. But can you not have it put into the passbook and use it through that? Because it's the same system, isn't it?
It is. I suspect it just isn't supported by Passbook. I think that's right. I think that's part of the problem.
But I mean, it's not difficult to get supported by Passbook, is it? I mean, it's presumably just an API.
I mean, I ran into this. When did I run into this? Yesterday. I was buying a vegetable juice. It's an incredibly hipster thing to do on lunch, but I did. I go to the health place a couple of times a week, and I buy a pressed vegetable green thing, and they have a loyalty card because the things are bloody expensive, and I give the loyalty card over to the person, and then I hold my phone next to the contactless reader. So actually, I have run into this problem, but it hasn't been a problem for me as recently as 24 hours ago.
Because obviously, if it's a loyalty card, they tend to be stamped, don't they? So while the person's stamping that, you can be paying with your contactless card. So it sort of works.
Yes, you're right. It is stamped. Yes, that's true.
So they've got something to be doing while you're paying. And then when your transaction's done, they can see on the terminal that you've paid and you're all good.
Oh, you are such an incredibly insightful individual. You see, that's why I like you. That's why we do this show, isn't it? It's for those like penetrative insights, you know, thrusting into the matter.
Yes.
Right. Sorry about that, everybody. Now, we had another email. This one is not about contactless. This comes from our long-time listener and I believe our ambassador, Luke, L-U-U-K, that is. Thank you, Luke, for listening to us for such a long time. He says, hey, Nate and Ian, and I'm going to pause it there, because last week, or was it the week before, we talked about the driving test in Britain needing to use a GPS from December as part of the test. And I said I couldn't find a single example worldwide of anywhere that's doing this. And I thought maybe the UK was first, although I did say I thought that was probably unlikely.
Yes.
Luke says, I'm afraid your research has let you down a bit. In the Netherlands, this has been implemented for about 10 years.
Well, there's a surprise. I mean, there's not a surprise, because for one thing, where's TomTom from? I mean...
Well, yes. And he says the practical exam consists of four parts. I'm not going to go through all of these parts, but one of them, he says, is driving with navigation. He says the examiner will tell you to program an address into your navigation system and then follow the instructions. So this is basically exactly what we're going to be doing. Luke says, I think the addition of the GPS navigation is a very sensible step, though it does tend to set you up as a more navigation-dependent driver to begin with. It's also important to keep up with changes in the world and in traffic. We'll see what the driverless car examinations will look like pretty soon, I think. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is a dependency. Well, thank you, Luke, for sending in that thought. I knew somewhere must have this as part of their driving examination already, so it's good to know that the Netherlands is ahead of the game. And if you live in a country that has this, by all means, write in and let us know. I'd love to hear more about it and see where else we're behind in the world. So thanks, Mike and Richard and other Richards and Josh and Luke and everyone else who's written in this week to podcast@nateslangston.com or tweeting us at textmessagepod. Before we end the show, let's check in with Tom Merritt across the pond and see what else has been going on in the global world of tech this week. Mr. Tom.
Hey, thanks, Nate. Lots of F8 news this week, the Facebook Developer Conference, where Patrick Beja and I discussed Mark Zuckerberg's grand new vision for an augmented reality future. And with Microsoft replacing Wunderlist with its new To-Do app, we talked about our own task managers. I myself don't even use one. I'll tell you why. Frightening, I know. We also got Jen Cutter's view on Twitch's new money-making options for streamers. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com. Back to you guys.
Well, thanks, everybody, for being here. A little bit of a longer show as well this week, which is fantastic, given that about 2 days ago I thought it was going to be a crap week because I had nothing really that I wanted to talk about. So it's worked out quite well. Please do consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/UKTech. You can find the links in our show notes at techpodcast.uk. You can find them in the MP3 description for this MP3 in your podcatcher as well. There's no commitment. You can give us a try for as little as £2 per episode for our longer cuts and various other things. And let us know any feedback as well. If you'd like to do this, but you're put off by something, then we'd welcome hearing the reasons for that as well. Podcast@natelangston.com is where you can send those to. And thank you to everybody who's supporting us there. It really does make a huge difference. And I think, unless there's anything else, Ian, I think we'll skedaddle, shall we?
No, I think that's pretty much covered it. We're getting perilously close to episode 100, though, aren't we?
Perilously close. And do we have ideas, ladies and gentlemen?
We do have ideas, don't we?
We do. We have ideas. That's it. Bye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.